The Guardian website is quoting the family of a 24-year-old Iranian asylum seeker as saying he's in a hospital in Brisbane where he's been declared brain dead. Hamid Kehazay cut his foot in the Manus Island detention centre. It developed into septicemia. Now he's reported to be on life support. Meanwhile, Fairfax newspapers are reporting that detainees on Manus who complain about conditions can end up in solitary confinement in windowless shipping containers. How do these kinds of events fit with Australia's legal obligations? The former Chief of Defence Admiral Chris Barry today launched a book called Refugees, Why Seeking Asylum is Legal and Australia's Policies Are Not. One of its authors is Professor Jane McAdam, Director of the Calder Centre for International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales. I asked her why the book argued that Australia's policies were illegal.
Well, the reason is that a number of our policies, for example, mandatory detention, certain aspects of temporary protection, the conditions of detention, pushbacks and so on, are not consistent with Australia's obligations under international law.
What about Australian law?
Well, as the book explains, what we are seeking to do is situate Australia's policies in light of our international legal obligations. There are certainly questions as to whether certain policies, and of course there are many, are consistent with Australian law as well. But our argument is that even some of our legislation is at odds with the obligations we've voluntarily signed up to under international law. And those obligations are not only things that we owe to individuals, but they're also contractual obligations, if you like, that we've contracted into with other countries. So when we don't live up to those obligations, we're actually breaking promises to the rest of the international community.
Is there anything the international community can do about it?
That's a question I'm often asked, and my favourite response comes from a famous British barrister who, when asked, is international law real, said, well, the $1 million governments pay me each year to defend their rights under international law suggests they think it is. And I think that even though in the refugee space we don't have a refugee court per se, there are certainly mechanisms by which Australia can be called to account, and indeed has been.
But as I'm sure you know, there are lots of people in Australia who say, damn the rest of the world, we should have our own policy.
Unfortunately for people who think that way, that's not the way international law works. And as I mentioned before, and as we explain in the book, international law isn't something imposed on Australia from the outside, but it's something that Australia has voluntarily accepted. And I think we also need to remember that in everyday life, international law functions perfectly well all the time. If you ring someone overseas, you post a letter overseas, you buy a product from overseas, all of that requires a whole lot of international law behind it. Of course, the only time it hits the headlines really is when something goes wrong.
But what about further down the track? Is there anything in international or national law that could end up meaning that Australia has to pay out large sums of money, for instance, as a result of actions that are happening now?
Certainly, if we look at some of our domestic legal frameworks, there have already been challenges under domestic law, for example, in the context of false imprisonment or negligence, those sorts of claims. And my understanding is there have been quite significant payouts. Most of the time, those cases have been settled. So we've never actually seen the courts themselves have to make a final judgment on those points. But if we think
that's within the domestic context. What about, say, if there were cases where people were sent back to Syria and ended up being tortured?
There'd be questions. I mean, certainly in terms of responsibility, there it could well be found to be a breach. The difficulty can come then back to, at the international level, what the remedy is.
So and if it's international law, those people might end up having no real recourse.
Well, certainly the issue with the UN Human Rights Committee, I mentioned a number of their cases before, the decision by that committee can't mandate the Australian government to do anything particular. I mean, it sets out what the Australian government is obliged to do, but the sticking point then is the mechanism to force their hand. And in another case, for instance, where Sweden was found to be in breach of returning someone to torture, the government there was highly embarrassed by that and went to great lengths to try and explain why that was an aberration and it was not the practice of Sweden to do that ordinarily.
But embarrassment might be the highest level of punishment.
But I think it may be in some cases, not necessarily always, but I think we shouldn't underestimate the value of or the impact of that. And I think Australians
but
should...
We know that there are governments around the world that are unembarrassable. There are government leaders who've been indicted for war crimes. I'm the leader of Sudan, for example. You can't get much more unembarrassable than that.
I think the difference, though, is that Australians like to think they live in a human rights respecting, democratic, law-abiding country that respects the rule of law and that also wants to be in a position whereby our leaders can call other governments to account when they see very serious crimes and violations being committed. And I think we don't want to be in a position where any comments like that look like sheer hypocrisy.
Professor Jane McAdam, and there'll be a longer version of that interview on our website from this evening.